Good day, fellow explorers. This is what we have for you on today's Impact Everywhere podcast.
As we open microfactories, there might be showrooms that are attached to the microfactories where you can come in. If you look at the amount of distressed real estate that's actually on the market today, I think there's going to be a lot of opportunities for us to find new and unique ways. And I think I'll really parlay, my background in the physical side to figure out how we do that and do that properly.
Hello, friends, and welcome to Impact Everywhere, the podcast that looks for people having a positive impact in unexpected places. Our guest today is Philip Robb, and he is the CEO of Model Number, which is a furniture company that 3D prints furniture out of food waste. Philip is also the co-founder of Beta, that's spelled B-8-T-A, and it was one of my favorite stores to visit while I was living in San Francisco, because you could basically play with the future. All those fun Kickstarter gadgets that you would see on the internet, well, you could touch them and play with them in his store. I was introduced to Philip by Mohammed Modaris, who, after I interviewed on episode 48, just thought that Philip could be a really interesting candidate for the podcast. And of course I said, why not? I'd love to hear the overlapping lessons between what it was like to run a futuristic franchise and his current endeavor, running a 3D printed furniture company that has a sustainability mission. In this conversation that took place live on Clubhouse, we hopped back and forth in the timeline, switching between what he currently does at Model Number, as well as the lessons that he learned while at Beta. With that being said, this is Philip Robb, and here he is talking about the current state of the furniture industry and why it's ripe for disruption.
The furniture industry is one of those industries where I think I was always looking at it from the outside in as a consumer, as I think most of us do. You see something that's well designed or something maybe that meets a functional need in your home. And a lot of times it's either one of two things. Either you're looking at something because you're very, very price conscious and say, hey, that's something that I just maybe need to, a quick bookshelf or something. It's going to be in the corner. It's going to be storage. I'm going to go ahead and buy the cheapest, most efficient thing I can find. Or maybe it's a centerpiece of a room and you go out and you say, well, I'm willing to spend a lot more and really consider it about the design and what that looks like. We don't really look at anything above and beyond the kind of form function aspect of things in the way that we are starting to look at a lot of other kind of high ticket items. If you look at the industry as a whole, it was always predicated on really design or functionality. And now I think people are starting to take a really strong look at the products that they have, whether it be their cars, whether it be the clothes, whether the things that they're putting in their body, of where do these products come from? And I think that was a question I think that we really looked at very closely at Model Number. One is to say, like, how do you actually deliver something that the customer actually wants, right? That isn't necessarily a cookie cutter kind of out of the box, but something that's customized to your personal needs, but at the same time doing it in a way that doesn't have an impact on the environment. Because if you look at the toxicity of furniture and if you look at the impact that it has from a supply chain, it's so destructive. And I think that's really where we're diving at Model Number. And I really hope that a lot of other companies start to look at it. And I think for us, I want to change the industry and the way that people really think about furniture, not just say, hey, you know what, like Model Number is the only one that can do this. I think others can do it and they need to start changing the way they think about it.
What I heard you describe there essentially with cheap furniture, I suppose, is the same problem that we have in every single industry. Like fast fashion, you have the same thing with fast furniture. So if you're building furniture out of something like MDF, which is made out of adhesives and wood chips, it's actually toxic. And you guys are trying to address that by creating a higher end of material that has a supply chain that is significantly shorter. Walk me through this vision of 3D printing of furniture. It's not a common strategy, right? There are not many people doing this. Why is that?
No, not at all. So a little bit background on the company itself. The company is almost 3 years old. I only got involved this past July. But for the first 2 years, the company was founded by three individuals. So it was Vonnie, Jeffrey, and Jillian. And they were working on a project together and they needed to make something that was more custom made. And they went out to try to get off the shelf products and looking at what was available and realized that anything that was out there today took a really long time. And then even getting something that was customized, there were limitations in regular manufacturing on what you could do. Because if something had to be done out of a mold, it couldn't be easily reproduced. And through that, the team started saying, okay, what if there was a better way to do this? What if you could start to customize furniture using automated production? So Jeffrey McGrew, who's our CTO and the co-founder, Jeffrey's background is in automated production and design. So he's a licensed architect. He was at large firms like Gensler. He worked at Autodesk and really over the years has perfected his craft and started to build the 3D printers from scratch. 3D printing was happening in where you're building parts now for large boats and yachts, for airplanes. It's starting to be incorporated in different things. You're starting to see companies out there building homes with it, but nobody was really doing anything in the furniture space. And so for the first 2 years, I think the idea was, is this even possible? Is this something that could be scalable? Can you create a product that you can take to a broader mass market? And I think ultimately the answer was yes, through about 2 years of R&D. And so then I was asked to join the company to say, how do we take this now and build a go-to-market strategy? How do we, you know, take it and make this kind of a viable product? And so that's what I've really been focused on, you know, over the course of the last 9 months.
Beyond just creating customizable furniture, you're actually using plastic that is created out of food waste. Can we take the time to break that down a little bit? How are you exactly taking food waste and converting it into plastics? And is this something that anyone else can do? Is it just about changing the feedstock for 3D printers, or is it a little bit more complicated than that?
It's a little bit more complicated than that. If you think about food waste, so let's take an ear of corn. You can eat the corn. You know, animals can eat that. Humans can eat that. But there's also parts of corn that you can't eat. We just can't digest as humans, nor can an animal, right? So there's the husks and all the things that get pulled off. That's excess waste. So what happens to that? Typically, it just gets either composted or thrown away or something. What happens, though, is there's now companies out there that are taking that excess waste, whether it be through corn, whether it be cassava, you know, beetroot. These are some of the different materials that our products are made from. So that there's suppliers we work with that will grind that down. And then from there, what happens is they'll grind it down into a very small pellet. And that pellet is then what goes through, and we put through our extruders that then ultimately, if you've ever seen kind of the 3D printing process, those extruders then turn that into a filament that we then print from.
One of the things that I thought was particularly great when I was researching you and the company was the origin of why the company is called Model Number. It's this idea of giving each an individual piece of furniture that you guys have created a model number. And the reason behind that I thought was really interesting. Do you think you could share that with us real quick?
Yeah, for sure. If you think about a car has a VIN number in the same way that our products have model numbers. If you were to go on the site, you'll see that there's actually typically a 3 or 4 digit number that's associated with a product. But then beyond that, there's different genomes that will identify what that product is. And so the idea is that each product is individual and you can go in and customize. So you can go on our site and go into the design studio and design products. So there's certain things that we have that we've found that people just really don't get, and they don't necessarily want to design too much. So we have certain presets where you can go in and do very light modifications. Maybe you can change the type of wood, you can change, you know, the color of the item, and then you can go in and adjust the length, depth, width on certain things. There's other things where you can go in and maybe do a little bit more modification on some of the 3D printing items where you can, you know, change the twist on it. And so each one of those has an identification. And I think where we think long-term we're going to take this is that by being able to identify those products over time, you can start to understand where the product is in the supply chain or eventually the afterlife, so to speak, of the product. So once it's been delivered to you, let's say that a couple years from now, you buy a product, you get a table from us and it fits a small apartment that you have, but eventually you move into a larger house and that table just doesn't fit because it's really small and you want something bigger. In theory, we're not there yet, but where we're going is that you could be able to send that back to us. We can take that. We've got an identification, you know, of the product. We can look in our system and say, okay, you purchased this 2 years ago. This is this item. This material cost X, whatever. We'll take this back. We regrind it down using the exact same material and now build you a brand new table. The idea of being able to have some sort of identification to everything, it really has a lot of benefits from as a consumer to be able to track and understand where that's going to, then ultimately understanding where the life cycle of the product has gone and come. And you know, who knows, as you think about even resale markets and things of that nature. I think it's just a really unique attribute that we have.
That was the piece of the puzzle that I thought was probably the most exciting because you kind of close the loop on a product. And in which case, do you foresee a future in which people no longer own furniture? They simply pay a subscription fee for a certain volume of furniture, and then they can consistently send it back and have it remade in a different shape, in a different form to fit their evolving needs during their lives.
That's one of our long-term hopes, right? Is that we're not necessarily going and taking out more I'd say resources from the planet in taking a lot of that out. It's more of making it regenerative. Like, how do you actually make your furniture and keep that? I think there's, if you look at antiques, there's a lot of pieces just that have held the test of time due to amazing craftsmanship, and that's great. And I think if you've got products that have lasted hundreds of years, that's amazing. I think, unfortunately, we live in a society today where, you know, things tend to be a lot more disposable. And I just even see that in my own generation with a lot of things. I remember just, if you don't take furniture, but as a kid, if I got a hole in my jeans, my mom patched the jeans up until they basically they were disintegrating off of my body, where I, or eventually outgrew them to the point I couldn't wear them. But now you've got fast fashion and things are so cheap that what happens is, like, oh, I can just go buy a new pair of this for, you know, $10-$15, and you get it and you realize that I think we're being extremely wasteful. And I think that needs to change in all facets of what we're doing. And I think, you know, from a furniture, you know, we think that the capabilities are there, and that's where we want to start heading.
Yeah, well, I mean, I remember reading a statistic. I think like 9 million tons of furniture ends up in landfills every single year.
Yeah, I think it's actually even greater than that. I think it's like 12.
Oh, it's gone up.
And if you look at it, like, yeah. And I think 20% of landfills are actually made up of furniture. It's disgusting.
Yeah, they take up so much space. And just having moved many times in my life, furniture is often customized to the space that you're in, meaning that people don't tend to keep it. So I really love this idea of being able to grind something back down to its component parts and then reusing it over and over again. So I think that's definitely something I find really exciting. I also read that one of your visions in order to continuously reduce carbon footprint is to create micro factories that are scattered around the country. Can you talk to me a bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So really the idea and the premise there is, if you think about manufacturing today, I'm all for globalization. And if you run kind of international businesses, I lived in Europe actually as a kid. And I think that I love the fact that as a world and we're coming together much closer, and that there's a, you know, understanding of different cultures and ways of doing things. But at the same time, I also think that manufacturing in particular has to become more localized, because otherwise we're going to just put too much of a burden on the things from an environmental perspective. And so if you look at it today, if you're manufacturing something, let's say in Asia, right, it has to get onto a boat and then, you know, gets into a port, and then all of the people that are touching it and then getting on trucks and going everywhere. Our thought is, like, through automated production, through 3D printing, through CNC fabrication, if you can have the raw materials that are available within the region that you're in, and we can have those. The idea is that we want to set up micro factories to the point where, imagine that you live in Chicago and you place an order. That shouldn't have to get made offshore in Asia or Europe. It shouldn't get made even in California. It ultimately should be made probably within 50 to 100 miles of where you live. So that order would go directly to a micro factory in, let's say, Schaumburg, Illinois. And from there, the order gets made because it's automated, right? So it goes right into the production queue and it gets produced 3-4 weeks later. That item then is then either, depending on the size of it, is either delivered to somebody's home or sent to them. And the idea is that the carbon footprint of what it takes to get that product from point A to point B is much lower. And I think that is what we ultimately want to get to, the point where we've got a series of maybe 25, 30 micro factories that are in the US where we can cover 80 to 85% of the population within, you know, less than 100 miles of where they live. And we think that actually is applicable in any market that we enter into as you start to look at, you know, international opportunities as well.
I almost wonder if there may be a future, sort of like how Cloud Kitchen, which is Travis Kalanick's latest thing after Uber, where they're just imagining that maybe in the future there'll be a lot more takeout than physical restaurants. So you can just build this commercial industrial kitchen that hosts a zillion restaurants that can then just ship out from one centralized location. Do you think maybe the future of manufacturing may look the same, where you have these micro factories that are just designed to produce a variety of different models that are locally available and reduce carbon footprint and get product to people even quicker?
Well, you could. Absolutely. That's the beauty of 3D printing and automated production, right? Is that you're not creating molds. The way that manufacturing, you know, traditionally had worked was that you would create a mold, and then that mold, then you would, you know, order a, you know, 10,000 of those items, and it would just go down an assembly line to produce that mold. If you wanted to switch and you wanted to change to something else, you would have to change the mold out. And so it didn't allow for you to be able to say, okay, well, I'm just making this very rudimentary. I want to make this one a circle, this one a triangle, this one a rectangle, and this one a square, right? You couldn't do that in manufacturing because you would have to go out and change that. It's very time consuming. There's a lot of other, you know, costs associated with that. In 3D printing and automated production, you absolutely can change that. And you can say, oh, this one is going to be this size and this one's going to be here. And you can do four different things, one after another, because of the way that the production is happening. And I think it's going to make it so much more efficient. And to your point, it'll allow for being able to produce different things at different times. As long as you have the skilled labor that can be able to manage that process, it completely makes it the whole thing in the supply chain much more efficient than I think it ever had.
Yeah, I think this would be a really interesting opportunity to pivot the conversation a little bit. It's really interesting to be in the time of COVID where you shifted from someone who is basically a specialist in creating retail experiences, retail as a service, into what is now essentially a 100% online service. What lessons have you taken from one world and transposed into the other? Like, has it helped you or is it just hard? Tell me a little bit more about that.
I've not only gone into a business where you're looking at a completely digital direct-to-consumer model, but it's also one that is with a product that generally had required a lot of hands-on, right? And furniture being a high-ticket item, it's things that people wanted to see, they wanted to touch and feel. And so I think that's added another kind of dimension and a little bit of a challenge, you know, think to what we're doing. But I think principles are the same. And that's where I think sometimes a lot of people get things clouded to say, oh, this is physical versus this is digital online. I'm really looking for a better word, but I know there's this kind of this notion that people kind of use the word omnichannel. I don't like the word in general because people really don't think about, hey, I'm going to go online to buy that, or I'm going to go into the store to buy that. You buy something because you want it and you're going to find the most convenient way to get that product. If you understand the mindset of the consumer and thinking about sometimes it is you want that physical touch point, whether it's actually to return a product, which is becoming even more problematic. It was really interesting. My wife now has 4 things that she needs to return, and she's finding that each one of them is requiring something different. So for example, there's a couple of items from Amazon that she wanted to return that she was going to be charged like $15 for. She's like, I'm not paying $15, but she can go drop it off at Whole Foods. So she's like, all right, well, I have to go to Whole Foods tomorrow to go drop that off. Or there's another company, they sent her the wrong thing and it's a $10 surcharge for her to return that item because it's a really small company, but they sent her the wrong item. So she had to call up. We're putting such limitations, I think, on people, especially in just online right now, because it was really the only thing that we had for the last year. And people want to crave more of a physical experience. And so you start to realize it's not necessarily just about one channel. We kind of view all of them holistically when we're dealing or talking to a brand. I just have to be able to provide the most optimal channels and opportunities for a consumer to engage with the brand. And sometimes that's going to be physical, sometimes it's going to be digital, sometimes it's going to be both. And that's really where the future of retail is going. And I think, you know, the companies you see that really embrace both are the ones that have been successful and will continue to be successful. The fundamental aspect of the way that you just basically treat consumers and think about the relationship that a brand has with a consumer has not changed, and I don't think it really ever will change.
I've heard you mention before the importance of storytelling. So in the past at Beta, you would have people walk into the store and they would own some of the products there, but just didn't know how to use it. And so you were enabling people to kind of walk in and you would have people there that would explain them how to use a product. And then along the way, they would discover all these other cool gadgets that were adjacently relevant to them. And then once people had a great experience, they would invite others to come with them and there would be this sort of like network effect that would propagate. What is the network effect of marketing furniture in an online space? How do you make sure that people hear the story that you have to tell? And you have like a multi-layered story, right? This idea of custom, environmentally friendly furniture that can be recycled infinitely, made from food waste. Like there's so many layers to this. So what have you found that works well as you try to communicate this outwards?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think at Beta, we really did take on that idea of storytelling. Our beta testers were brand ambassadors. And there were times where they were maybe teaching consumers about a new product or introducing a new product to people. Or there were times that we're teaching people just how to unlock different features or how to use products that they maybe already had in their home. We found that a lot when we had our partnership with Google, that there were so many people that had a Google Assistant, but really didn't even understand like how to use it or all of the different benefits and attributes. When I first started Beta, I remember talking to some of the original teams. And in fact, as co-founders, we used to, on a rotating basis, be the managers of the store, which was always fascinating. I used to always tell people, you need to think about the store and your relationship with somebody that comes into the store of almost being like a cocktail party that you're hosting. Like when somebody comes into your house, you want to show them maybe something that you just purchased, or somebody will have a question about like maybe a piece of furniture or a piece of art or something in your home. And you're a storyteller, right? You're telling maybe the backstory of where you found that piece or how it came about or all of these things. And I think for me, that was always the North Star at Beta. It was never about trying to push something on somebody to buy that item purely because you were trying to have it hit a quota, because our business model wasn't set up that way. And I take those same level of thinking, and I'll be honest with you, we're not there. Like, we have a ton of work to do right now, I think, at Model Number. We just going to be bringing on a new head of marketing. And really what I'm, you know, working with him on is to say, we need to have a really strong content strategy. We need to be able to get people really immersed with that product to feel the backstory. I just met up with my old co-founder, Vibhu, yesterday, and he showed me this amazing website. It's called Imprint Space. And it really is about makers, like showing these like ceramics and kind of wood, like just showing the individual whittling kind of the wood and just the true grit and backstory behind how you make something. And I think that's where we're trying to get. It's more videos of showing how the product is actually made. I want to even get to the point where like I can get to the process of seeing food waste and really, you know, almost getting, you know, to the underbelly of what we're doing. And I think that's really important as a marketer and a storyteller, that you can really have that emotional connection with people, because that's where ultimately I think we're going to build that trust in the long term and understand the authenticity of who we are and what we're building.
I just pulled up imprintspace.com and looked at their stories, and I think it's really cool. Like, they're really focusing on the process of creation, not just the output itself. And I do think that that's something that we lose in a lot of these sort of automation-based creations. You lose kind of the entire backstory, which is what makes something so cool. In the work that I do as an artist, I've always found that the stories behind how I get to the final result are almost more important than the final result themselves, because that's where people can actually relate to the struggle, the challenges, the hard work, the teamwork, and the collaborations, and all the different ebbs and flows of, I guess, what it means to be human. And that gives the final product even more meaning and even more personal connection.
If I can interject, I look at what you're doing and all the artwork around the awareness and the impact towards plastics. And I'll just give you a little bit of a story. Last January, I was in Puerto Escondido, which is a small little beach town in Mexico in the province of Oaxaca. And beautiful, really rustic. We were at a very remote place on the beach with a couple of like huts. And every day, it was maybe like the second or third day I was there, and I would just go out. And again, very remote. So it wasn't like there were a lot of people around and partying and just throwing waste, but you would see all of the plastic that would come up every day. And you would see sometimes beach turtles and all these animals and stuff. And so every day on my run, I went to and asked for a plastic bag the first day, and I filled the plastic bag up while I was running. And then I like got my wife and I'm like, you got to come with me because I need more plastic bags. And so every day we would like on my run. And I think for me, it was so powerful to see that, because it became to a point where like I was on this, you know, having just a very relaxing time, wasn't really doing anything. But to me, the highlight of my day was actually when I would go out on my run and feel like, you know, I was collecting, and it would just make me think about the amount of waste. It made it so much more real for me. And I think that also empowered me to say, I need to do something about this and I need to get more involved. Ultimately, I think that was one of the things that led me to where I'm at. But I think it's just, you said, it's those backstories that really push who we are, where we go with things. And I think people really like to hear about that, because that's the true, I think, kind of authentic element of it all.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's even a word for that activity that you just described. It's called plogging, P-L-O-G-G-I-N-G. And it was started in Sweden as a movement to run and pick up litter along the way. Yeah, plogging. It's actually a thing. I have a hard question for you, or maybe it's not hard. If I look at the time of the kind of work that you were doing at Beta, which is essentially trying to get people to buy more stuff and things and cool gadgets that they probably don't necessarily need, because it was all about marketing innovative things. And of course, what we need versus what we want is a really hard distinction to juggle.
For sure.
But
yes.
But I'm curious, like, why did you shift from this retail world of trying to get people to just buy more stuff to now focusing on this low volume, high impact, sustainable? I mean, there seems to be like a really different direction there. Was that a personal choice? Was it just happenstance? Was it this rise in consciousness from the plogging that you were doing?
Within the last couple of years, my mindset, the things that are important to me have changed quite a bit. So I think, I don't know if it's maybe as I have two kids, as they start to get a little bit older, I see what's the world that I'm leaving for them? What are the things that I need to be conscious about in raising them that they need to be mindful of? Spending more time, I think, just in general, kind of, you know, outdoors and outdoor activities. And as I've gotten older and mature, I think maybe that obviously has lended some aspect to things. But I would say from a business perspective, where it really all changed for me was in November of 2019, we launched a concept at Beta called Forum. If you really at the time thought about beta, we started around consumer electronics and more tech enabled, you know, type of products. We started to move into more health, wellness. We started carrying beauty, personal care type of products, and even started dabbling a little bit. And we had a couple of kind of performance tech type of apparel items. But we always knew that beta was going to be much more than just that. And we didn't want to get pigeonholed as just being a tech company. And we launched Forum. With the first location was in LA on Melrose. And the idea was that with Forum, we were going to start to carry more apparel, accessories, venture into being more seen as a lifestyle brand as well and have that. So it was Forum by Beta. And we chose to keep it very localized because we knew there were a lot of amazing makers in LA that wanted to be able to talk about their craft. And you know, we started working with a lot of mission-driven companies. A lot of them were focused on sustainability, reduction in water, in production, in apparel, and all of these things. But I realized that while we were working with these great brands, I don't think we were always being necessarily true or having our most authentic voice in marketing that. Because the idea was to say, look, we're working with all these great companies. Look at it. They're mission-driven. They're sustainable. But we weren't marketing them in that way. And I knew that I wasn't going to fundamentally shift the entire company to be that way. It wasn't who we were. It wasn't where we were. It would just completely change the moving and the ship around. And I didn't, that wasn't the right thing, I think, for beta. And I still don't think it is. But for me personally, that's where it really started to kind of change. And I said, gosh, this is actually a thing. People actually care about this. Brands are caring about this. This is really, I think, the future of commerce. And that was what led me to say, I got to be doing something different. And I think that started to really captivate, you know, I think me to a point where I think by like February or March of last year, I was really getting that itch.
Got it. That's cool. I mean, I do feel like it's one of those things that just slowly seeps in. And then once you start caring, you can never go back. And it's good to see you joining in on this journey. And it's all about progress, progress over perfection. It's just about making those small steps to see what we can do better.
I 100% agree with you. We have to embrace the fact that everyone's going to come along on this journey, but it's going to be at a different pace. Sometimes where you get people that are, you know, oh, you're not doing enough, or you say you're this. I think it was Everlane came under a lot of scrutiny for certain things and the practices. It's like, yes, absolutely. But we should be there trying to say, this is what you need to be doing better, not trying to troll or hate on somebody because they're not doing enough. Let's say, hey, you know what? That's great that you guys are doing this, but let's do this better. Like the same thing, like at Model Number, we're not perfect. I mean, in a lot of ways, I'm sure there's things that we're not doing that we could be doing. And there's probably some materials or substrates that maybe that we should be using where they're not. So rather than somebody chastising us for that, say, no, hey, did you actually know that you could be doing this or this type of material exists? That's what I want. I want a culture really to be built around that. And I hope that we can build a community around that as well, where people are empowering one another rather than trying to take each other down.
For sure, for sure. I think that's one of the really cool things about entering the mission-driven space is that everyone is sort of trying to help each other become better because they want to inspire a new generation of companies. It's very similar in the activism space myself, where I create art, but ultimately I want everyone to be able to copy what I do, or at least the intention behind what I do. Are there any brands that you look up to that you try to copy when you think of how you're building up Model Number?
I really love what the team over at Allbirds has done around shoes and really thinking about the materials that they're using and the mission that they have. If you look at the design of our products and you look at the design of their products, it's very unconventional, right? If you looked at their shoe compared to what was else in the market, most people, you know, at first would be like, really, that's going to be successful? Because it was different. But again, it was something that was innovative and they had an amazing story behind it. They were extremely comfortable, right, in the materials and the things that they were using. But then you saw Amazon, you know, I think through their basics, try to come in and hack it. And what was the response that Allbirds had was like, hey, we'll share with you. We're here to do something much bigger and we're confident in our brand and we're confident in what we're building that it's fine. You want to go ahead and copy this? Yeah, like you can do that because I think for us, obviously there's certain things that we have that are proprietary that I need to obviously protect as the CEO of the company. But I look at it and say, no, I want to make sure that people understand that we can do things differently. We can do it better. We need to be more altruistic in that aspect.
Yeah. Most recently, I think Amazon Basics copied Peak Design on one of their bags. They're like, yeah, if you don't care about fair trade practices and you want to support slavery and you don't care about the environment, go ahead, buy the Amazon product. Yeah, it's terrible. Real quick, one more question before I pass off the mic to Anish. Do you see a world in which beta and the work that you're doing at Model Number might have a little bit of a fusion? So think of the experiential model of new age, more sustainable companies out there in order to celebrate new innovations that are happening. Do you see something similar happening in the future?
Ironically, the only place that you can see model number products today in the physical realm is actually at the Beta store in Palo Alto. We do have some of our products on display there. I do see a world where we will have to have, you know, some physical manifestation of kind of what we're doing in order to grow the company. I don't think it's going to necessarily be in the classic way that you see large furniture companies where they go and open 5-10,000 square foot retail outlets throughout the country. There's a lot of different ways. As we open micro factories, there might be showrooms that are attached to the micro factories where you can come in. If you look at the amount of distressed real estate that's actually on the market today, I think there's going to be a lot of opportunities for us to find new and unique ways. And I think I'll really parlay, I think, my background in the physical side to figure out how we do that and do that properly.
Ooh, I love that. Distressed real estate is a term I've never heard before and couldn't agree more on this idea of showrooms attached to microfactories as a really powerful way for storytelling. Before asking more questions, I'd love to invite MCK over here to ask a question. He's been sitting up here on stage for a little while. MCK, do you have a question or comment that you'd like to add into this conversation?
Phil, I have really enjoyed today's conversation, have a ton of takeaways. And I guess the one question that I was also thinking about was, you had said that channeling this energy of like, this is what you can do to make this better rather than trolling somebody for not being enough. I think I really resonated with that. It was also interesting because you said it right after you and Vaughn were talking about how going in this more sustainable direction or mission-driven sustainable companies being a focal point at Beta. And then you said, you know, it's not really right. And you believed that that wasn't necessarily right. Given all your interest in and around this area now, what makes you say that it wasn't right? And how do you channel in that energy of we could do it a little bit better? And what would be maybe a pathway to do it a little bit better alongside the rest of the business?
Yeah, it's interesting because I caught myself saying that as well. What I mean by that is that at Beta, at that time, you know, we were 250 people. The business was in a particular direction. And we had already committed, I think, to certain fundamentals of where we were for, you know, strategically. And to go in and to all of a sudden to change the culture and say, hey, guys, all of a sudden, we're going to change the business model. We're not going to do this. You know, we're going to be more, you know, sustainable and this and that. I think there are certain aspects of that that we could continue to do. And I think that for the most part, if you looked at the company and you looked at the mindset, myself, my co-founders, we all had a fundamental belief in being genuine, a culture. It was a very inclusive, very transparent organization. But at the same time, we did build that around. We were building stores. We were doing a lot of things. And our investors, if we went back and said, hey, look, all of a sudden, we're going to just totally flip this thing and do something different, I think it would have been a really big challenge. And I don't know if we could have necessarily been able to completely change the entire dynamic to say, all of a sudden, you know, we're going to be this eco-friendly, sustainable company and where we were. I think we just weren't in the position to do that. And so I think there were a lot of things that in order to keep the company going and doing that, which my co-founders have done an amazing job since I've left the company to be able to keep it alive and to be able to do, I think, all the great work that they're doing. But I think fundamentally, we could chip away and do certain things. And I think some of the things we were doing with Forum, if you look at also in Forum, for example, in New York, they partnered with, I think the name of the company, I could be incorrect, so don't quote me on this. I think it was Bomb. I think it was, I think Black Market or something. It was really empowering makers of color to be able to do really unique things. So I think the company as a whole, we really had a very strong mission in the things that we wanted to do, be able to promote small brands. But I think on the sustainability front, that wasn't where the business was going. And tried to doing something like that, that would have been very challenging and difficult. And I don't think it was the right thing. And so for me personally, if I was going to do that and feel like I was going to do something differently, I felt like it was probably going to be within a different organization that I was going to have to do it.
Cool. Yeah, makes total sense. Thanks for sharing.
So to hop onto what MCK just said, so I know during COVID, you stepped down as president of Beta to kind of help free up some cash flow because as a retail first business, obviously there were a lot of challenges that Beta was going through. And so I think you're also not part of the, like you're a board member these days, so you're not necessarily in the weeds. So you're not, it's not within your power to,
correct,
to really change the direction of anything. But for a company like Beta, you know, when I look at the situation from the perspective of a storyteller, I see Beta in a prime position to tell a narrative of hope and opportunity in which technology, humanity, and the environment can coexist in an exciting and innovative way. If you were to restructure or shift that culture to include a sustainability component to it, and I know many corporations are stuck in this exact dilemma that you just mentioned, what do you think would make something like that work? And what would the greatest challenges be?
I think the greatest challenge is you can build it. You can easily build a story. It's like an amusement park for environmentalism, right? That's not hard, right? I mean, throughout my career, when I first started Nintendo, I was tasked with, you know, how do you change the retail landscape in big box retail and tell the story of video games that were traditionally targeted towards, you know, a young male audience, and now how all of a sudden do you make it accessible for your moms? And that's what we did, and we built the store of the future, and we actually rolled them out in some cases and did these really amazing things to communicate what our mission at Nintendo was at the time around kind of family gaming, which is had never been heard of. And I think we were quite successful in doing that. This was the around Wii and Wii Fit. And then it carried that over to the things that I was doing at Nest and being able to sell $250 thermostats in big box retail like Home Depot and Lowe's, where traditionally you had people shopping for $30 thermostats. And so storytelling at retail, communicating, I think if you have a great story and message, is really, that piece is not difficult. The difficult piece is getting people to actually take action. And I think that if you build that, it's like, how do you get people from saying yes? If you ask people a question, do you want to live in an environment where there's clean air, where there isn't garbage on your street or garbage in the ocean and all of these things? The answer, people are going to say, of course. But the question is like, how do you actually get people to take that next step to do and to take your action? And I think that's where you have to understand. And this is the thing I love that's happening with so many of the younger generations is that it is, you have a group of individuals that feel empowered to say, yeah, I can do that. I can make a difference versus actually creating more of the problem, which maybe past generations had. Like, how do I now do that? If we create a retail space or an environment or just things in general, it's not about the message as much as it is like, how does the message instill behavior?
And so when you look towards the future of retail and you look at all the innovations there, all the different stores that are trying to redesign experiences that are built on the back of consumption, how do you think this tension between sustainability and the desire to grow and create new innovative projects, how do you think that's going to self-resolve itself? Do you see it resolving itself, or do you see it actually going to just emerge as two alternative schools of thought or something similar?
Well, that's a big question. I think the one thing that I've found and I find most troubling about where we've most recently headed as a society is that there is this camp of you're either on one side or another. We've become very bifurcated in a lot of ways that there isn't a lot of middle ground towards things. I hope that we can get to a point where it's not about, well, it's either I just want to buy a bunch of stuff, just leave me alone, or hey, you shouldn't be buying a bunch of stuff and type of thing. But being more mindful of, yes, there has an impact. And if you can get somebody to even reduce their consumption by 10 or 15%, that's an accomplishment. Versus other people may say, hey, I'm going to completely eliminate and I'm going to be a plastic-free house. Not everyone's going to get there. And I think that's challenging. Where I think a lot of this change has to come from as well is pushing large corporations to get their head out of their asses and say, hey, you know what? No, you shouldn't be doing this. Or this is causing a lot of problems. You need to fix this. You fix it now, not waiting till the government tells you have to, or doing things for the wrong reasons. If you look at even a lot of these companies that are pushing electric vehicles, they're basically creating these huge incentives to get these vehicles on the road just because they have to hit a certain number of electric vehicles. But they're still probably producing more cars than they should, versus certain other companies out there have, I think, maybe a little bit more of a, you take like Volvo, who probably is probably a little bit more mindful of that than maybe another car company is, right? And so I think that's where we need to get to.
Interesting. And for really big corporations, we spoke a little bit earlier about how hard it is to shift culture. For an even bigger corporation to immediately take responsibility, it's super tough. At least in the conversations that I've been a part of, you see all these goals that corporations set, their 2030 goals, or maybe their 2050 goals. And invariably, more often than not, they never hit them. What do you think we can do to hold people or companies more accountable?
You know, it has to hopefully start with the culture and the cultural shift of a company. And I know that MCK brought that up earlier about thinking with beta. And I think it is something that I grappled with for sure. How do you do this? And even as the founder and as the president of the company, you're still beholden to certain individuals. It's about getting the board more closely aligned. It's understanding it. Actually, there is a strong impact that you can have on the things that we're doing to change. And this can be beneficial from a financial perspective. I think I look at one of the most classic situations. You look at Ron Johnson, who was the former head of retail at Apple and the CEO at JCPenney, when he tried to, this was probably back in 2012, 2013, when he tried to change the whole landscape of the company and change something different. And I think he was onto something, but the valuation of the company dropped by 50%. It tanked and they ultimately fired him. But I think the company stuck through it. I think his turnaround probably would have worked eventually over time. He was on the right path. So you see what happens when somebody tries to make really fundamental change. And I think a lot of times that can't happen unless if it's still a large founder-led company. If you look at Amazon, right, up until recently when Jeff Bezos said he was stepping down, the reason that company continues to thrive is because you still have the founder at the helm who took risks and wasn't scared to say, hey, we're going to do things differently, or I'm going to go out on a limb and do that. And I think that's why if you look at some of the most successful companies still out there today, it's typically because there's either founder-led or a family-led company that's not pressured by a board, that knows that they can actually continue to make change. And those are the ones that, you know, I think I really admire, and they're doing, you know, really amazing work.
Got it. Cool. Sorry for the hardball questions. I'm just always interested in sometimes digging a little deeper to ask the questions that have no answers, no right or wrong answers.
I love those questions. I think those are the fun ones.
So. Yeah, for sure. I have one last question for you before letting you off. And that is, what do you think was non-negotiable before that is negotiable today?
At one point, it was, even I remember early days at Beta, like when we were out talking to investors and looking at a business. And I think you look at maybe where things have started to shift a little bit. I felt like it was this revenue at all cost mentality. You just had to grow the business. It was grow. And I think a lot of companies got in trouble with that. You saw it happen. That happened originally in the original kind of dot-com bust, boom and bust. And then you saw a lot of companies that got into that mentality. And there were a lot of direct-to-consumer brands, I think, that fell trapped you to that, where they were just growing this brand, had a great brand, but fundamentally, maybe their business model wasn't strong. And I think you're starting to see that's changing a lot from a business perspective. And I think you're going to see this even more as we move forward. And I've talked to a lot of large companies, and I've talked to a lot of suppliers and people that are working with large companies. And as people start to have a strong corporate responsibility team in most large organizations, it now has a really strong voice. And I hope that because of that, that creates a lot of change in large companies. But I hope that also too, that there's a lot of people who feel empowered as small entrepreneurs, as people coming in now and starting their own companies, that they can feel that they're not going to be punished because they're doing the right thing, or because their product is going to cost 20% more because they are utilizing a more sustainable method or more materials, or because they're thinking about those dollars are going to something that are going to have a little bit more impact on society. I think that's something that we're starting to see a fundamental shift. And I think it's going to only continue to grow in that thinking, and innovation is going to exacerbate it. And I'm really excited about that. And I think that's something that I would say before wasn't necessarily negotiable, but I think to you today definitely is.
Amazing. I love that. What a great note to end on. Hey, Phil, thank you so much for your time today. I really enjoyed this conversation and I learned a lot. Thanks for coming on today and sharing your knowledge, wisdom, and time.
Awesome. Thank you for having me. And thanks for all the participation from the group. I thoroughly appreciate everyone taking the time and spending with us today.
Alrighty, folks, that was Philip Raub. His name is spelled P-H-I-L-L-I-P space R-A-U-B. And he is the CEO of Model Number. That's Model space N-O. If you want to go check out the platform and play around with their website, where you can actually customize furniture and get a preview of what it is that they are trying to do. You can also head over to Beta, that's B-H-T-A.com, to see what he was doing in his past life. For those of you who are looking for the show notes, you can head over to impacteverywhere.club, where you can see more graphics, audiograms, summaries, and all of that good shareable stuff, as well as up-and-coming events and interviews that will be taking place live on Clubhouse. With that being said, folks, I hope you stay positive and inspired, because impact is everywhere.